You're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today is April 4th, 2011, and on Write the Book this afternoon, you'll hear an interview with award-winning novelist Kate Atkinson. Kate Atkinson was born in York and now lives in Edinburgh. Her first novel, Behind the Scenes at the Museum, won the Whitbread Book of the Year Award, and she has been critically acclaimed and an international best-selling author ever since. She's the author of a collection of short stories, Not the End of the World, and of the critically acclaimed novels Human Croquet, Emotionally Weird, Case Histories, One Good Turn, and When Will There Be Good News? Her latest novel, which we discussed in our interview, is Started Early, Took My Dog. Case Histories introduced Kate Atkinson's readers to Jackson Brody, former police inspector turned private investigator. The book won the Saltire Book of the Year Award and the Prix Westminster. When Will There Be Good News was voted Richard and Judy Book Best Read of the Year. After Case Histories and One Good Turn, it was her third novel to feature the former private detective Jackson Brody, and he makes a welcome return in Started Early, Took My Dog. Here are a couple of reviews of Kate Atkinson's work. The Sunday Times writes, it doesn't really matter in what genre Atkinson chooses to write. Her subject is always the irrecoverable loss of love and how best to continue living once you have glumly recognized that that was what the world was like. Things improved, but they didn't get better. That's a quote. Her gift is presenting this unnerving and subversive philosophy as a dazzling form of entertainment. And the author Harlan Coben says simply, Kate Atkinson is an absolute must-read. I love everything she writes. When I spoke to Kate earlier this week, I asked her to talk about her character, Jackson Brody, who is quite lovable, but he's not without his flaws.
For one thing, I think it'd be impossible to write a perfect person, because I often think, you know, writers are drawn to evil and badness and unhappiness and tragedy because it's very difficult to write about happiness because happiness is quite boring
right.
in many ways. But also, you know, what would happen in a happy life? And I think the same is true of good character, you know, good people. It's very hard to write an entirely good character and or a perfect one. So all of the interest for the writer and I presume my hope for the reader is in the flaws, because that's what literature is always about, from Greek tragedy onwards, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's the flaw in the character. So I don't think he's heavily flawed.
No.
But on the other hand, I don't find him as attractive as many women readers do. So he's, I think he gets marks for trying, because he does make an effort to be on the side of good.
Right. It's not just the readers who find him attractive. In this book, he gets absolutely flocked by women.
Yes. I guess women do find him attractive.
Yeah.
But I don't think any of these women actually find him attractive.
No.
I think this is one of his problems. He tends to get surrounded by women who just get annoyed by him for one reason or another.
Well, I know you didn't originally set out to write a series of books when you first wrote the first novel featuring Jackson Brody, which was called Case Histories. And so I wanted to ask you about writing a book where you have to catch readers up on what happened in the last book in case they didn't read it. That seems like something of an art form in itself, to do that without it being summarizing, and yet you do it very well. So I wonder if you can talk about that.
I don't actually think I do it. I've realized that now because you're not the first person that's asked me that this week, and I hadn't thought about it very much because I don't catch up on the books at all because the books are pretty much standalone.
Yeah, yeah.
Really. I think I just ignore whatever's happened in any of the previous books, but the character himself I tend to have to make some catch-up on, and especially if he's also got returning characters like Julia, who
right.
pops up in all of the books. So, but you, I find, because I don't like that. Oh, and then, of course, so far in his life, Jackson has done this, he's done that. That's sort of, as a reader, I find that kind of tedious. So I have the most limited shorthand for reintroducing him. I think probably I should do better. I actually realize that I've not been making much of an effort to bring people up to date with him. So he tends to, and I tend to ignore everything that's happened, because I notice, I don't know why, I try very hard to avoid myself on the internet, but I noticed there were two or three blogs and conversations about who is Courtney, because Courtney's a child who's a character in this book. I think
right.
he is Courtney. And they were all going, I'm sure she'll tell us in the next book. And I'm thinking, no, I won't. Because I don't carry over plot.
Right.
I just carry over characters.
Right, and I suppose there are certain themes for your characters that will be explained because they are constantly in their minds, you know, like Jackson's sister and his history with
yes.
his family. So I guess that's sort of what I was noticing more, maybe. So so this book is called Started Early, Took My Dog, and the title comes from an Emily Dickinson poem. And I love that Jackson has discovered poetry. You want to talk about that?
He had to in order to explain the title, because I tend to have titles, I love titles, and I can't write without a title, but I tend to have titles that don't have books attached to them, and then I suddenly realize that this is a book I can write. So I start with a title that has no relevance to what I'm going to write, because I don't ever really know what I'm going to write. But I think it's quite a handy device, because you then, you don't have a blank page, you have something written down. And it may sound stupid that something as small as a title is a help, but it is, because it gives you a kind of focus for your thoughts, and then, you know, you can start to somehow get all those accretions that end up in a book. So I wanted to write a book that had the title, the first line of an Emily Dickinson poem as its title. Because her first lines, I mean, her poems are phenomenal, but her first lines are fantastic. They're so insane, so many of them. I mean, the woman is crazy. And I kind of settled on Started Early, Took My Dog. And then I felt I couldn't leave that title hanging there with no context at all.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why he gets interested in Emily Dickinson's poem, to give me an opportunity to quote from Emily Dickinson, because it's slightly out of character for him. But he is someone who had no education, and he is a bit of an autodidact, I think, and he does believe in self-improvement, which, you know, has become a very old-fashioned Victorian kind of virtue these days. But he does believe in improving the mind, even though he keeps that thought quiet to himself, I think.
Right.
So, and two, he discovers classical music in this book as well. And I think my father was an autodidact. He was also from the north, and he had a very deprived childhood and no education. And I think taking Jackson back to Yorkshire was important for me emotionally in some way. And this book is actually dedicated to my father, and I hadn't really thought about it, but I think in a way there's something of Jackson that has an echo there, I think, because my father, you know, at the age of 14, went to classical concerts, not even having heard the name Mozart, and, you know, applauded wildly in between movements in Beethoven's symphonies because he didn't know that you weren't supposed to do that. And he loved books as well. And I think there's an echo there of this Jackson's desire to somehow acquire the better things
right.
of the mind.
Right. And I remember in Case Histories, was he learning French?
Yes, he was learning French in order to can retire
to go,
to the good
right.
life in France.
In France,
which,
right.
This is all a bit collapsed with the recession. But then he stopped in the subsequent books having an interest in French. And bizarrely, because the BBC's just finished filming the first three novels, and he's learning French throughout the three novels for no reason. And I keep saying to them, why is he learning French? You never say why he's learning French. And they go, oh, we think that's quite interesting. I'm going, no, it's not. Everyone wants to say. They say, oh, same series. We'll explain why he's learning French.
Maybe
but
he's,
it is interesting.
Maybe he's just an optimist.
He does actually. No, actually, at the end of the first book, he goes to live in France, and
yeah.
in the second book, he comes back. So it's not that it didn't work for him. It's just that he realized that, you know, he was too restless to settle in the middle of nowhere in
right.
France.
Well, I noticed that he loves poetry. I also noticed that he doesn't like fiction, or it's not been his thing. And he has a line in the book that's great. He says, facts seemed challenging enough without making stuff up. Which seemed like
yes.
a great policeman's point of view, or detective point
yeah.
of view.
Yeah, he's a pragmatist. He's not, you know, fiction holds no interest in him. I know a lot of people who don't read fiction, and, you know, and people are always going to go, people should read more, you know. This, and I think, well, I don't think they necessarily should. I know I shouldn't say that as a writer, but, you know, I think he holds the position that, you know, is what's so good about reading books. And I think maybe he's going to discover novels in the future. He does have a go at it, but...
No, I always love it when I'm reading fiction and I come across a character who doesn't like fiction. I find that very interesting. I don't know why, but it is. I remember Jan Fowles did that in The Magus, the Greek, I forget the character's name. He doesn't like fiction at all. He goes off on this huge rant about why, what's wrong with fiction. It's fun.
Somebody obviously deep in a writer's character needs to express the dislike of what they do.
Right, that's it. Oh, and then this is just a little thing, but while we're talking about his likes and dislikes, I love Jackson's reaction to the exclamation points in Hope's emails, which is hilarious.
I think it's because Julia speaks with exclamation marks, and they have no real meaning. I use exclamation marks a lot in emails and texts because... especially if I'm saying something that's not very nice, because I find it softens, because it confuses people. It's like, oh, that looks like an incredibly jaunty exclamation mark, but what she's saying is horrible. I think I'm a bit of a Hope uses them in a very positive way.
Right, you're just trying to confuse people.
Yeah.
Well, I wanted to talk a little bit about the structure of the book. You've done this really interesting thing. All of your books are so interesting, but interweaving certain scenes as seen by different characters. So, for example, we see the child you mentioned before named Courtney shopping with her, I'll just say, horrible caretaker, Kelly. We see that from Tracy's point of view, and then again from a character named Tilly's point of view. And then soon after that, we see a supposed shoplifting scene through Tilly's perspective, and then also from Jackson's perspective. I thought that was really interesting that you kept kind of showing us different angles of the camera, so to speak.
I don't use that enough, but I would like to do a really precise, high concept book that was just the same event from different characters' perspectives, I think, because I've always found that very interesting. I did the Alexandria Quartet for my degree thesis long time ago, my dissertation, and I think that's, oh, I say this like with such confidence that that's the same story from different viewpoints, but actually I can't remember a word of it. It was so long ago, but I do think it's an interesting narrative device, but I suspect it might be more interesting to the writer than it is to the reader, because perhaps by the time you've got the fifth viewpoint of the same event, you go, yeah, you're new, let's move on from this. I don't know.
Right.
But I like that. I like that sense of texture, I think, that you get from layering things like that, so that you're not... it's not confusing the reader, but it's just giving them this extra dimension of narrative, I suppose.
Right. Yeah, and I think it's kind of fun because it's reflective in nature, and actually you sort of do that thematically too. You sort of created, I guess I'll call them reflective experiences for different characters. So, for example, something that happens to Tracy and something that happens to Jackson, or decisions that they make, will take them into similar parallel experiences.
I did want those two characters, because I have fewer characters in this book than I think all of the other Jackson books. And Jackson himself, who plays varying roles in the book, sometimes he's the main character and other times he's very much a minor character. Because the last book, When Will There Be Good News, belonged to the female characters. He was, you know, in a coma for most of it. But in this book, he comes back, and I wanted him to have a much bigger role, and I wanted him to parallel Tracy. I wanted someone, you know, that they would pair. And my original intention was that they would meet up quite early in the book, and they would have a kind of antagonistic, humorous, road movie kind of relationship with each other. And then I got to something like page 250 and they still hadn't met. And I thought, I can't really do this. I couldn't physically within the narrative get them together because they were on such different paths that I just couldn't do it. And they do meet really late in the book and have no kind of humorous. It is quite an antagonistic encounter, but no humor and nothing at all in the way that I'd envisaged. And they actually sort of just kind of dislike each other and go off. And that was that. So it's quite interesting that a lot of my original plans, because I wanted him to come back and solve his sister's murder, and so that there was a sort of a full circle there. Mm-hmm. And the word he hates, closure, and that never happened either, because it wasn't where the book was going. So my starting intentions are frequently very different from what happens in a book, although interestingly, I usually end up at the place that I thought I was going to begin with, which I always find curious. So no, so I didn't. But their actual lives, they're both ex-coppers, they're both of a similar sort of age and experience, they're both from the north, they both rescue something or someone, or Jack's case, the dog, and they both end up having to look after something that they didn't expect to, and they're both looking for something. Well, I don't know, perhaps Tracy's, Tracy's trying to run away from something, Jackson's trying to run towards something, I suppose. So there was, but it was almost, I didn't plot it, I wasn't thinking, now he needs to be like this and she needs to go there. It was a very natural sort of development.
Does that, when things don't go the way you thought that they might, is that interesting and exciting to you, or is that frustrating?
No, no, because I don't plot books. I don't plan them. I don't have some big wall chart where I work out where everybody's going, what they're going to do.
So you don't have a huge emotional investment in that necessarily?
No, no. I mean, my planning, if it happens at all, is very much very sort of small-scale micro-planning to do with the next chapter or something like that, just so that things are in the right place. But I tend to, I know what a book, I know what I want it to feel. I don't, this is very curious because it's very abstract, but I know what I the reader, I don't know about other readers, but I, the reader of this book, want to feel like when I finish it. And it's to do with ambience and something mysterious. And that's what I'm trying to create, I think, more than the plot. So I would be very bored if I knew what was going to happen, but I also know that I've tried that approach and it doesn't work, because I immediately go off piste as soon as I start writing. It changes because I think as I'm writing, and it's a very organic process, and I just have to sort of follow each sentence really almost, and I'm much more confident doing that now. I used to think it was a ridiculous way of writing and that I would be much more organized, and then I wouldn't get stuck, because I often get stuck in, you know, kind of byways and cul-de-sacs and places I hadn't meant to go. But now I feel much more confident about just following it where it goes. It's not that it's out of control, clearly I am in control of it all the time, but I just let it develop more naturally, I think. And so it's much more interesting to me that way. I think a lot of writers do write in order to find out what happens in their books.
Well, this might seem like a kind of odd question, but I wonder if you yourself feel like a different person when you're working on a section that's from one character's point of view versus another. So, for example, Jackson and Tilly couldn't be more different. So do you feel like a different writer at moments when you're working on their different parts?
That's an interesting question. I like doing internal narratives and of characters, and I like having, you know, several characters' viewpoints, and all of these books tend to do that. They go from one character's viewpoint to the next. But for me, it's quite an easy way of writing, because you just jump inside their head. You know the characters so well. I mean, a writer knows their characters intimately from the minute they appear. You have a very big overview of those characters. And it's just really easy to jump inside their heads, I think. Mm-hmm. And it's also quite a relief sometimes, because you think, oh, I've had enough of that character, and you're going to move on. But it's an instantaneous thing, so you inhabit those characters. I inhabit those characters very easily. But it's always me.
Yeah.
Or I would be mad. But I enjoy that. I enjoy stepping inside this character's head, because I like the kind of the stream of consciousness kind of writing, I think.
Yeah.
Because it always feels very natural,
right,
I think.
Now, I've mentioned Tilly a couple times, and she's a character who's an actress, and she's also starting to succumb to a certain level of dementia in the book. Do you remember what inspired you to write about her? I really enjoyed her character. I really felt for her.
I don't know. I had planned to put in a different character, her friend Phoebe, because her friend Phoebe, who's really terrible, not a friend at all, who doesn't appear in the book until he just speaks about her, was a character in a story I wrote for Glyndebourne, had the opera place in England, had an anniversary, and they asked me to write a story based on an opera. And Phoebe was a character in there, and I loved Phoebe. I thought she was a great character, so she was going to reappear. And then somehow she was just not right, and her friend Tilly emerged from somewhere. And I just, because Tilly's, the reason Tilly's in Yorkshire is because she's in a been given a part in a long-running sort of police soap. It's a police drama.
Yeah.
And which is a sort of, and Julia's in it as well, his ex-girlfriend, and he hates it, and there's a certain redolence with Collier and policemen and all of this. And she, I just needed another character who wasn't like the other characters somehow. And it's, I don't know where she, I mean, I, you know, I do know where she came from, and that she wasn't Phoebe, but somehow she just, she sort of appeared in that shopping mall scene, and then was there, because she's not really part of the main action of the book, although she is involved. I mean, she does have a part to play. So it was quite interesting to have a character who was doing something, for most of the book, who was doing something completely irrelevant to the rest of the book, because I knew I was going to pull her in and she was going to have her part to play. So that was quite nice. It was like taking a kind of sideline off and just having fun with her awful dementia. But I really enjoyed writing Tilly, because I was asked at a reading last night if I knew someone with dementia. I think I laughed, because actually it's a terrible thing, but I do know quite a lot of people with dementia, but Tilly wasn't based on a person with dementia. She was actually based on me in many ways, because I naturally inhabit that person who's just totally losing it and forgetting it all the time, and who feels their mind is wandering. And I found her very close to my own thinking in some ways, and also because I do think a lot about dementia, because my mother's in a nursing home, and she's not demented, but many people in there are, and it really makes you think a lot about your own fears about losing your mind,
sure.
Which is obviously a great fear I have, I think.
Well, it's good that your mother doesn't have dementia. It's probably good for you too. It probably means
yes.
Yeah. I was going to ask if you could read from the novel, just a couple pages, to give people a sense of it.
Yes.
Okay, great.
Okay. 1975, Leeds, motorway city of the 70s. A proud slogan, no irony intended. Gaslight still flickering on some streets. Life in a northern town. The Bay City Rollers at number one. IRA bombs all over the country. Margaret Thatcher is now the new leader of the Conservative Party. The beginning of the month in Albuquerque, Bill Gates founds what will become Microsoft. At the end of the month, Saigon falls to the North Vietnamese army. The black and white minstrel show is still on television. John Paulson is still in jail. Bye bye, baby. Baby, goodbye. In the middle of it all, Tracy Waterhouse was only concerned with the hole in one of the toes of her tights. It was growing bigger with every step she took. They were new on this morning as well. They had been told that it was on the 15th floor of the flats in Lovell Park, and of course, the lifts were broken. The two PCs huffed and puffed their way up the stairs. By the time they neared the top, they were resting at every turn of the stair. WPC Tracy Waterhouse, a big, graceless girl, only just off probation, and PC Ken Arkwright, a stout white Yorkshireman with a heart of lard, climbing Everest. They would both see the beginning of the Ripper's killing spree, but Arkwright would be retired long before the end of it. Donald Nielsen, the Black Panther from Bradford, hadn't been captured yet. And Harold Shipman had probably already started killing patients, unlucky enough to be under his care in Pontefract General Infirmary. West Yorkshire in 1975, awash with serial killers. Tracy Waterhouse was still wet behind the ears, although she wouldn't admit to it. And Ken Arkwright had seen more than most, but remained avuncular and sanguine, a good copper for a green girl to be beneath the wing of. Despite pleas from her teachers to stay on and make something of herself, Tracy had left school at 15 to do a shorthand and typing course and went straight into Montague Burton's offices as a junior, eager to get on with her adult life. "You're a bright girl," the man in personnel said, offering her a cigarette. "You could go far. You never know, PhD MD one day." She didn't know what MD meant. Wasn't too sure about PA either. The man's eyes were all over her. 16, never been kissed by a boy, never drunk wine, not even Blue Nun, never eaten an avocado or seen an aubergine, never been on an airplane. It was different in those days. She bought a tweed maxi coat from Etam and a new umbrella, ready for anything. Or as ready as she ever would be. 2 years later, she was in the police. Nothing could have prepared her for that. Bye bye, baby. Tracy was worried that she might never leave home. She spent her nights in front of the television with her mother while her father drank modestly in the local conservative club. Together, Tracy and her mother, Dorothy, watched the Dick Emery show of Steptoe and Son, or Mike Yarwood doing an impression of Steptoe and his son, or Edward Heath, his shoulders heaving up and down. Must have been a sad day for Mike Yarwood when Margaret Thatcher took over the leadership. Sad day for everyone. Tracy had never understood the attraction of impressionists. Her stomach rumbled like a train. She'd been on the cottage cheese and grapefruit diet for a week. Wondered if you could starve to death while you were still overweight. "Jesus H. Christ," Arkwright gasped, bending over and resting his hands on his knees when they finally achieved the 15th floor. "I used to be a rugby wing forward, believe it or not." "Aye, well, you're just an old fat bloke now," Tracy said. "What number?" 25 at the end. Her neighbour had phoned in anonymously about a bad smell coming from the flat. "Dead rats, probably," Arkwright said, "or a cat. Remember those two dogs in that house in Chapel Town?" "Oh, no, before your time, lass." "Aye, up here we go, Tracy. You'll smell it from here." Tracy Waterhouse pressed her thumb on the doorbell, kept her there. Glanced down at her ugly police issue regulation black lace-ups and wriggled her toes inside her ugly police issue regulation black tights. Her big toe had gone right through the hole in the tights now, and the ladder was climbing towards one of her big footballer's knees. "It'll be some old bloke who's been lying here for weeks," she said. "I bloody hate them." "I hate train jumpers," Arkwright said. "Dead kitties," Tracy said. "Yeah, they're the worst," Arkwright agreed. "Dead children were trumps every time." Tracy took her thumb off the doorbell and tried turning the door handle. Locked. "Oh, Jesus, Arkwright, it's honey in there. Something that's not about to get up and walk away, that's for sure." Arkwright banged on the door and shouted, "Hello, it's the police here. Is anyone there?" "Oh, Tracy, can you hear that?" "Flies." Ken Arkwright bent down and looked through the letterbox. "Oh, Christ." He recalled from the letterbox so quickly that Tracy's first thought that someone had squirted something into his eyes. It had happened to a sergeant a few weeks ago, a nutter with a squeezy washing-up bottle full of bleach. It had put everyone off looking through letterboxes. Arkwright, however, immediately squatted down and pushed open the letterbox again and started talking soothingly the way you would to a nervy dog. "It's okay, it's okay. Everything's okay now. Is Mummy there? Are you Daddy? We're going to help you. It's okay." He stood and got ready to shoulder the door, pawed the ground, blew air out of his mouth and said to Tracy, "Prepare yourself, lass. It's not going to be pretty."
Oh, thank you for reading that.
Sorry there were so many swear words in that.
I might have to do some editing right there. That's all right. Are you comfortable enough now with police procedure that you don't need to do much research with each book, or is that still an ongoing part of writing these?
Well, I do have a couple of pet policemen, and I question them usually at the beginning before I've written the book. And but I do. I actually make up quite a lot. I think everyone does. And that's what I'm making up is, I think there's not that much police procedure in this book. So,
right.
And also, because the police procedure that is in this book is in the past. It's a long time ago, and you know that things have changed and nobody remembers anyway. So if it's contemporary, I try to get all the right phrases and everything. But of course, I'm in Scotland, which has a different legal system and a different police system from England, so I think a lot of the time I might be applying Scottish procedure to English. nobody's actually pulled me up on it yet, but
nobody's,
I'm sure they will.
Nobody's. All right. You have a couple of characters whose voices end up, let's see, that's not quite right. Julia, Jackson's ex, is kind of I don't know if she's a muse to him, but her voice sometimes exists in his head, sort of commenting on what he's seeing and what he's thinking, even when she's not there. And then another character in this book, whose name is Kitty, who used to be a model, she has a voice inside her head as well. It just made me laugh. She narrates her daily life. It's just wonderful. Everything she does, she like narrates it as though she's the star of her own show. So I wonder if you can talk a little bit about both of those.
I think people do that.
You're right.
Outside of yourself and in some ways and do that. I'd forgotten about Kitty. It's not terrible. I forget about my characters so quickly. I did like Kitty. I liked writing Kitty a lot. But she does have some problems, I think. She's not entirely mentally stable, Kitty. I think she has a sort of, I think, you know, she's a neurotic. I think neurotics do tend to comment on this. But Jackson's always had voices in his head.
Yeah.
He's always had the women in his life are always speaking to him because he knows, I think, exactly what they would say to him at certain points. And you do know what people would say to you, don't you? I mean, everyone kind of knows what, you know, those nearest and dearest to them would say if they could see them doing things. So I think, but it's always with him, it's his exes really who talk to him. So his wife used to be in his head a lot more, but since, you know, the divorce is fading into history, she speaks less for him than Julia does.
Right.
So I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know who will speak to him in the future.
I call Julia his ex, but she's really an ex-girlfriend, whereas his wife was Josie, right? Is that?
Yes.
Yeah.
And I think Julia lingers on in his life because she's the mother of his child, so mm-hmm. you know, they can now never be. I think she says, you know, two become one, and that's it. They'll never get away from each other.
Right, right. Well, I understand that we're short on time. I've got one last question for you.
Mm-hmm.
Can you offer advice for fiction writers who are trying to develop characters that are, you know, complex and honest on the page?
Mm. Well, I don't develop characters. They come fully formed, and that's such a hackneyed phrase, but it's true. Mm. So I don't really know how you develop character.
That's not ever been a challenge for you?
No, because I don't sit down to construct a character, and I think that's a problem in your writing. If you think, right, I'm going to make this character and they're going to be, you know, 5'8" and have a mean disposition and blue eyes or whatever, you know what I mean? So you take things and you make your character from them.
Right.
Whereas in fact, I think characters arise naturally from the writing, and I think it's I hardly ever describe characters. You very rarely would be able to know what a character looks like from my books because I'm inside their head. So I think it's very important to get inside the head of the character, but also to make them part of the book, not to try and get them created and then up and running and doing things. So it's all got to come very naturally, I think, because if you artificially construct a character, I don't think it works as well as just somehow letting them. It's difficult, isn't it?
Yeah.
I'm really interested in character. I love character. And I'm very interested in how characters are made and how they form because it's a mystery to me. It really, really is. I just don't know how characters come into being because as soon as they're on the page, they are there. They you don't have to start adding to them. They're just there.
Yeah.
And that's very, very odd, I think.
Well, thank you. I think being inside of them is a great place to start, you know, to make sure that you're inside of their heads and trying to see what they would do in certain situations. Yeah. So, well, Kate, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Yeah, it's a pleasure.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Kate Atkinson. This week's Write the Book prompt is inspired by the interview you heard today with best-selling novelist Kate Atkinson. This is a pretty simple prompt. Find a line in a poem that you like and let it grow to become something you can write about. It doesn't necessarily have to become the title of your piece, and it doesn't necessarily have to be about what the poet was writing about. In our interview, Kate Atkinson said that she began this latest book knowing only that she wanted to use Emily Dickinson's line, "I started early, took my dog." And she turned that into the title. She took off the I, and her title is, of course, "Started Early, Took My Dog." She said during our talk that if you know your title in this way, you don't have a blank page, you have something written down, it gives you a focus for your thoughts. So whether you use a favorite line of poetry as a title or merely as inspiration is up to you. Give it a try and see if the blank page looks less daunting in this way. And good luck with this exercise, and please listen next week for another. If you are interested in sharing Write the Book with friends, let them know that they can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3 if they can't get it on their radios. Of course, on the radio, it's at 105.9 FM. Archived episodes are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. And a reminder, if you have comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. You can also send writing prompts to that same email, and I will happily credit you for any prompts that you might share. And the email, again, is writethebook@gmail.com. So as I said, I had to do a short show today because Kate Atkinson only had so much time available. And so we're going to end a little early. I'm going to put some music on from the Big Heavy World archives. And then Cheryl Willoughby will be here with you at 3 o'clock, bringing you the world of music. So this has been Write the Book. I am Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to Community Radio, The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont. Thank you.